Today's Taisho will be on case 9 in the Blue Rock Collection, Joshu's Four Gates. Engo's Introduction. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. With the Bakuya sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one comes. Life is found in death, death is found in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Secho's verse. Its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was as clear as jewel. There stood the gates, north, east, south, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. Earlier in the Sesshin, I mentioned that Master Joshu had studied with Nansen for many years, and then after Nansen died, he was supposed to take over Nansen's temple, but went on the road and encountered great Zen masters all over China. And in the Blue Rock Collection and the Gate of No Barrier, there are stories, koans, that are based upon some of Joshu's encounters. This one, in this case, he's visiting some temple, and a monk came up to him and said, what is Joshu? What is Joshu? Everybody's talking about this great master Joshu. What is Joshu? And then Joshu says, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Now, it might be worth knowing, although it's not worth that much, that the word Joshu, is also the name of a place, a town, actually. And so somebody says, what is Joshu? He's saying, like, it's like the town. It's got a north gate, a south gate, an east gate, and a west gate. So that's the koan. Now, you know, all of you are doing a really wonderful job. I have to say that I've been very happy with everybody's practice. You know, a lot of Zen practice, it takes time, and lots of sesshin, actually. You know, you've all been doing a wonderful job, and everybody's been making really good progress. But you know, there's a process you go through. And there's no escaping it, and you have to go through it many times, you know. When you're living your life before Zen, at some point you begin to feel that something's missing, maybe. I mean, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or tell you why you came here, but generally speaking, people get involved in Zen because they feel something's unsatisfactory in their lives. And they feel maybe boxed in or blocked. And they have been perhaps feeling that way for a long time. And maybe not. Some people get this feeling very early in life. And some people have to, you know, struggle with it for a long time. But, you know, I certainly felt that way. You know, I was talking earlier in the session about my upbringing. And, you know, you might say, well, why do you talk about yourself so much? it's a good question. It's not because I think I'm particularly interesting. It's just I don't know what else to talk about when I have to do sesshin, teishos, you know. Because I really don't think it's a good idea to talk about philosophy, right? I think that's really like the worst thing you can do. And so basically I just try to tell stories that are related to the koan, you know, a little bit. And the only stories I really know are, you know, people in my family and so on, and things that have happened to me. So I'm just, there's nothing intrinsically interesting about any of this. I know that, you know. but it's just all I've got to work with, right? And I do think it would be a great crime to do philosophy here in this context. That would be like inviting everybody to get... tracked all over again, you know. You know, using my own life as an example is not such a bad idea, because it means I'm not recommending anything to anybody that I wouldn't recommend to myself. You know, so I think that's an ethical thing to do. In other words, I'm not saying don't do something I wouldn't do. I'm saying, you know, for what it's worth, here's how I got to where I am right now, and you can reach your own conclusion about it. You know, so you know, here I go again. You know, but you know, my dad was you know, very unhappy guy, and used to lecture me, as I was saying the other day, on the need to be like number one. And he was you know, felt like he was a big failure, and his father felt like he was a big failure. And so, you know, I would be looking at my father's finger pointing at my nose and looking up at his fierce face. And, you know, this had an inhibiting effect on my life, as you can expect, because it made it very difficult to learn anything, like in school, you know. Because, as I mentioned, I didn't really want to learn anything. I just wanted to get good grades. I wanted to be number one. It didn't matter how, you know, really. I wasn't going to be the football star, that was clear. And I'm not an athlete. And as I said, you know, I wasn't a ladies' man, as they say, you know. So the only thing left was like to try to be smart, right? So, you know, I did, you know, really study hard. And it was thrilling to get good grades in school, because it meant I was developing like I was going to be number one, and Dad would be happy, right? So this was a really bad way to go through your intellectual development, in my opinion, because I didn't try a lot of things that could have been interesting. You know, so I tended to do things that I knew I could win at, you know. So when I took courses in college, you know, I really liked getting good grades. So I didn't take any sort of courses that might be sort of far from my expertise, you know, my skills or my strong suit, you know. I got a lot of good grades in English and the humanities courses, and I could have maybe tried some science courses, but then I thought, oh well, you know, I might not get an A, you know, and that's a great pity, isn't it? But I was afraid of not being good, and so I tended to just sort of repeat myself in school over and over again, you know. I would do this, take this, you know, courses. Actually, I was good in anthro and English, so. You know, I would take anthro and English every semester, and I did get a deeper knowledge, but I let a lot of stuff pass me by that could have really enriched my life, but I was too scared to try it, you know? And there were a lot of things in life that were like that for me, that I was just too scared to try new things. And, you know, when I, when I first got involved with my wife, my wife is very much more spontaneous, or was maybe, I think I've changed a little bit, but a much more spontaneous person than I used to be. And, you know, when we went to Mexico together, I really planned it all out, and you know, I had the maps and I had the tour books and everything, which I actually think is not a bad idea. You know, if you're going to go to another country, you might as well know something about it, you know. So I don't want to say, you know, if you just get off the plane in Turkey and spin around and go, you know, that would be like a bad idea, right? You know. So you know, we wanted to go to Mexico and we wanted to look at Teotihuacan, the Aztec capital, and the Monte Alban. I was saying Monte Alban, and then Carlos corrected me. He said Monte Alban. Very gently. He was very tactful about it. He said, ah, Monte Alban. So, it's like Zhao Zhou, Monte Alban. Monte Alban. So I went to Monte Alban, you know. Anyway, you know, the thing is, it's good to plan, but, you know, when things didn't go right, it would really get me, you know. When you know, so, like, if the guidebook says, when you get to Los Mochis, there will be a train station, you know. If there wasn't a train station, it would really get me, you know. And I would get very nervous about this, you know. I'd get very frightened about this. Frightened, you know. And so, you know, a lot of our trip wasn't that fun for me, because I was so tense about all of these details, you know. And of course, we did have a good time. I mean, the ruins were incredible. We went to these, they're like pyramids. Teotihuacan is like this, these pyramids outside of Mexico City. And the day we went out, it was like a movie, right? You know, we took this bus out of the city, and we drove out, and we drove out to the countryside, and there's all these beautiful plant, you know, trees, tropical trees, and a palm tree plantations where they, you know, grow coconuts, you know, and then you come into this area which is just a breathtaking. It's like not just one pyramid, but it's like a whole. It's a crossroads. Two roads intersect, and there's pyramids all the way down the road. It's like a road of pyramids on each side, and you can climb up the pyramid and look around over the jungle, right? Really, and the day we came, a dust storm came up, right? So there was just like this dust storm, and then it cleared, and there were the pyramids, right? So we did have these moments where I did enjoy myself, you know, that I was able to relax. But a lot of the time I would get very tense if things didn't go according to plan. You know, and that's very much the way I I was because of my upbringing, you know. Maybe also, you know, my father was a military person. And, you know, we lived on military bases, where everything is highly regimented, and there's a big emphasis on doing everything by the book. I remember one day I was driving, I had just gotten my driver's license, and I was driving around on base, and I was driving by the base headquarters. It was the base headquarters, and it was, you know, they were taking the flag down, you know, so at the end of every day, they would take the flag down and, you know, play, I guess it's taps or something, and take the flag down, and you have to fold it a certain way and this sort of thing. Well, anyway, I drove by, and what do you know, an MP pulled me over, a military policeman. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "You know, we took down the flag." And I said, "What?" You know, he said, "You were supposed to get out and salute." You know, and I was like, "But I'm, you know, I'm only 16 years old and I'm not in the army. You know, and why are you yelling at me?" But that was sort of the world I grew up in, right? You know, so okay, you know. So, gee, you know, I didn't know. So anyway, you know, very tense. And you know, this goes. These habits tend to build up over time, right? You know, they become part of your way of dealing with everything after a while. So, you know, I go along in life and find myself tense a lot of the time. Unwilling to try new things and so on. And, you know, I don't know, I got to I was living in Seattle and I had applied to go to graduate school. And, you know, it was very frightening for me to apply to graduate school because I thought, this is a new thing, you know, I might not succeed and I won't be number one, etc. Ran into this meditation class at the local, there was a Tibetan center I can't remember what street, but near the university area. And I went to this and there was no resident teacher, but somebody told me that this Japanese Zen master had been coming to town. So I went to sit with Genki Roshi. And there was something about it, I couldn't say what it was, but it just really felt good to meditate. And it felt so good to do this. And I didn't know why, but it just felt so good. I was going to a sesshin early on in my Zen practice career. And we used to have a sesshin over on a place called Vashon Island at one time. And we used to have to take a ferry over to Vashon Island in Seattle, the beautiful city of Seattle. There are many islands and you have to take ferries to some of these islands. So we would all get on the ferry, and these are ferries where you drive your car onto the boat and then you can get off and you can go upstairs and have a cup of hot chocolate and look out the beautiful windows. And actually there's orcas and eagles. It's really quite beautiful. So I was up there with a woman named Abby Terrace was her name. And she was just talking about her Zen practice. And she said, "I don't know what it is about this Zen, but I just feel like I've been waiting for this all my life." And she said, "You know, this, I just feel like this is like the most delicious water, and I've been, parched for years." And I just thought, wow, that is exactly right. You know, that is exactly right. There was something about sitting which was just so liberating because it got me out of my obsessive compulsive, I think the reason is, that I got out of my obsessive compulsive mindset a little tiny bit every time I sat. And I felt a little tiny bit better every time I sat, you know. And, you know, it wasn't like this, you know. I started sitting with Genki Roshi, and then that summer my wife and I went to Mexico again. And I said, "Schedule be damned, you know, we'll just put it by ear, eh, you know, Barbara, you know, and her new man, Kurt, you know, my God, you've changed, you know." It wasn't like that, right? It's not like that. It wasn't like that, you know, but it little by little, it is possible to change, right? It is possible to change. You go to sesshin, and what you expect is, basically what I was expecting was enlightenment, right? Remember, my dad said, you've got to succeed, you've got to be a success. So naturally, at first, Zen was liberating me from the big finger of my dad, right? who told me this is how you have to live your life. But after a while, I turned it into the same thing, right? So it had been liberating, but what do you know, I turned it into a jail again, right? Because, of course, I had to be number one in my practice, right? So I had to sit longer than other people, you know, I had to, you know, do full lotus, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there was a strong competitive dimension to what I was doing. And I was desperate for, I wanted the teacher to say, my God, you know, you're the reincarnation of so-and-so, you know, where have you been? We've been looking for you for years, you know, or, you know, something like that, you know, the next Hakuin, you know, wow, you know, or just, you're my favorite student, right? You know, oh, thanks, I knew I was. This is like, these are like common human fantasies, right? I mean, we all want to be worthy, you know, we all want to be worthy. And we all, you know, that's just how it is. So when I went to Zen practice, I wanted so much to be approved of by Genki Roshi, you know, and to be validated, and yet, you know, it didn't work that way. It was very frustrating and embarrassing, you know, because I couldn't pass my koans, you know, and so I had wanted, you know, to come to Zen. I mean, you know, nobody just has one reason for doing anything, right? I mean, sitting made me feel better even when I wasn't happy about it, you know, because the practice is just liberating. It's so liberating that we can't even screw it up totally no matter how hard we work at it, you know. So there's just something really liberating about this path, you know. So I would feel better in spite of myself, in spite of all my attempts to turn Zazen into a big prison, you know. I would still feel better after doing it, you know, so I stuck with it. So there, it was this liberating practice, no matter what I did to try to make it less than liberating. But at the same time, you know, I was turning it into a jail for myself, you know, trying to distinguish myself and be special, and which is nothing to be ashamed about, because everybody wants that, right? Everybody wants that. So I was I wasn't the only one in the Zen group who was like that, right? Everybody's like that. You know, this is what it means to be a human being, you know. But we make ourselves miserable as a result, right? When you go to Sashin, what you want is to answer the koan, and the teacher will go, you're special, blah, blah, blah. Great, you know. But what happens if you work with koans is that instead of playing to your strengths, you know, I always took English courses because I always got A's in English courses. Going to Sashin and doing koans is like being an English major and then finding yourself in like physics, right? You know, and I actually took a physics course. Let me tell you, in high school. I had no idea what physics is about, you know. I mean, I read science books, but our physics teacher didn't know what physics was either. Mr. Mikovich was his name. And he wasn't a professional physicist. I don't know where they got him. But he actually used to give us the chapter, and then he used to go outside and smoke. You know? And then he'd come in and he'd go over the quest problems with us, you know. So Mikovich was not a great teacher, but I couldn't figure this stuff out to save my life, you know. So going to Sashin and doing koan practice is like being an English major and suddenly you're in a physics course. You're not playing to your strengths. In fact, it's like taking the course you always feared taking, right? This is why Hakuin Zenji called koans. Hakuin used to refer to them as those vile koans. Right? Isn't that interesting? You know, he wrote a few himself, but he understood, you know, we don't like to take the course that isn't playing to our strength. So, you know, basically, when you're dealing with a koan, it's sometimes they're rubbing sand in your eye. You know, sometimes they're forcing you to deal with something that you might not want to deal with, right? This is sometimes the case. So, koans can be like that. But even if they're not about identity, or there are koans that actually deal with, like, things you fear, or, the experience of loss, or things like that. There are koans like that. Not getting what you want, you know. All these koans are painful because you sit down on the cushion and you suddenly have to face something you fear. Or you see, you know, I didn't get into medical school. Or you see something, you know, and you have to work through it. You know, and working through it means, you're sitting on the cushion and, you're trying to imagine yourself in a certain way, and the koan is going, no, that's not how it is. That's not how it is. You know, and so you're pulling this way, saying, of course I'm a very freewheeling and relaxed person, right? And the koan's going, you're scared all the time, right? You're going, not me, I'm casual, I'm. So it could take a while, right? And eventually you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, this guy in the koan story that I felt superior to is actually me, right? You know, that some koans work that way, right? That's an interesting dynamic, you know. So finally we get an insight into some aspect of our own patterns of behavior in the world, right? Some koans are like that. But not all koans work that way. Some koans are asking for you to experience the moment in a way that's not your habitual way of experiencing the moment. So, for example, the mu koan. You know, the mu koan is asking you to experience the moment from this standpoint of this empty mind, right? And this is very difficult for people to do because we're mostly addicted to ideas and thoughts and plans and dreams and our identity is tied in with that. So, you know, sitting in that blankness and experiencing the world without those things, it can be very difficult and maybe painful sometimes. And usually, you come to a sesshin. And there's usually some tension or pressure building up between your habitual way of seeing things and where the koan, what the koan is trying to show you, you know? And that's often a kind of pressure that builds up, not always, but often a kind of pressure that builds up in the process of working with a koan. And it's the reason we can't always like answer the koan right away, because we're blocking, right? Now, it's not really the koan that's blocking us, though. See, that would be a big mistake to think that. The koan is just basically asking us to look at something. But it's something we don't necessarily want to see, or it's something we can't yet see because we're stuck in our habits, right? We're stuck in our familiar mental games of having all the guidebooks and the maps and everything all set, and then you get out of the bus and you're not in Guanajuato, you don't know where you are, nobody speaks English, and you start going through the ceiling, right? That's the how koans sort of work, in a way. So basically, what can happen in a sesshin is you're calling mu, let's say, and little by little, for a long time nothing happens, right? You just sit there and you're going mu, 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 nothing, right? And basically this is really a situation where you are somewhat blocked, right? That's really one way to put it, you know. There's no sense getting upset about it or blaming yourself, because everybody who works with a koan is blocked. That's why we're working with koans. And koans actually are like looking for the things that you're afraid of. So there wouldn't be a point in giving somebody a koan if if there wasn't a block to dissolve. So the function of the koan is to reformulate your mode of experience. Basically, when you're calling mu and nothing is happening, you can experience a kind of deadness or flatness, right? And you just have to be patient. You just have to keep calling. And as I said the other day, the point is not to... as soon as you're trying to answer the koan, you're in the wrong mode. Don't worry about answering the koan. Become one with the koan. Become one with the koan. Totally one with the koan. And so, it takes a while to become one with this empty mind. And there can be like a subtle resistance or fierce resistance, So a subtle resistance would be like, suddenly you realize, I really want to daydream. Screw this koan, I'm going to daydream, And you just have these luxuriating daydreams. Or, that can happen, right, people do get mad, there have been a number of sesshins where people just, by about, usually it's by day three, they just go out of here in a fury. I mentioned a person who came here once, and she was just furious that she couldn't swim in the pool, right? And I said, well, that's not part of Chan tradition. The pool dip is not part of Chan tradition, of Zen tradition, So I'm sorry, She was just furious. You could hear the gravel. When she took off, it was like you could hear the gravels flying from under her tires, Really, it was like that. I could hear, the screech in the gravel, There is another person, and it's usually people make a pretext. It wasn't really about the pool, if I may say, wasn't really about the pool, was it? It's about not wanting to confront our blockages, right? There was another person who came here, and we've had about equal numbers of men and women, so I'm not, this particular case also was a woman though, and she said she got very upset because she said she came to see me after a meal and just said, I can't eat like this, and I'm exaggerating her hostility because I'm telling the story, but she made it clear to me that she couldn't eat in this insane way, that we rushed through every meal, and that there was a lot of pressure to conform. And eating, So I said, fine, I'll make you a thing and bring it into your room. I did. I said, fine, I'll make you a little meal, you can eat, you can just leave during the mealtime and come into the kitchen and pick up your meal. And, that wasn't good enough either, actually, that was not good enough. Before we made the arrangement where she would eat by herself, though, she wouldn't be finished all her food in time, right? And so basically she resented having to eat so fast. And a couple times I noticed, I could see at the end of the table, she still had food in her bowls, but she piled all the bowls on top of each other with all the food in it, and then just put the napkin on top. It was like saying, well, screw you all, I was having a couple times. I'm sending you a message, I'm not going to eat and I'm going to pile the bowls into the... it was like the end of day three and I'm tired too, right? So I'm going to bed and, I'm lying in my bed. And I can hear somebody pacing out in the hallway, pace back and forth, It's like, oh, don't tell me, finally tap, 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 and I have a word with you, it's like, oh, okay. And so, let me give you a piece of my mind, you fascist, So this is really not about my being a fascist, it's really about... not wanting to confront our blockages, right? So anyway, left that night, you know, zoom. So basically, these things happen. And but, you know, the whole function of the koan is to help us encounter our blockages. And they're not just personal or psychological blockages. They're, you know, perceptual. You know, as we're growing up, we make misjudgments about reality, and because we just live in a realm of common sense and folk wisdom and nonsense and so on, and our senses are very gross and unrefined and crude. So, you know, when you do zazen for several days, your senses become more acute. You remove obstacles, and you become much more aware of the world. And so, you know, that doesn't necessarily make things easier, because sometimes you encounter these problems in yourself that you otherwise wouldn't notice. So, you know, it isn't the case that you go through one sesshin and then you say after that, that's it, I'm, you know, changed man, you know, changed woman. What really happens in life is that we go to a sesshin and we encounter an obstacle, and we become aware of certain patterns sometime in ourselves, and then we basically have a little breakthrough, and we go home, and, you know, what do you know? After a couple of days, we're making lists and consulting the maps again, you know. But little by little, over time, really are transformed by this process. Really, it's really possible to be profoundly changed by this process. If you're working on your koan and you're quote unquote not getting anywhere, that's to be expected. You know, the best solution to that problem is, as I said the other day, is more sitting. You know, just the more time you spend on the cushion, the better. And you know, there have been people who have been really putting in those extra hours. If you're just beginning, if this is your first sesshin, or you're fairly early on in your practice, you know, probably the 8 hours we do is quite enough. You know, and you should lie down and get plenty of rest in between. But eventually, if you've been to enough sesshin and, you know, you're feeling blocked, the solution is always more zazen, always. And, you know, you just have to sit in front of the blockage, sit in front of the wall long enough, and something is going to change in yourself. That's really how it works. So if you're working with mu, you know, just keep coming up to that blankness, over and over again. And, you know, you may feel frustrated, bored, angry, whatever. But sooner or later, big mind is going to activate, and the universe is going to call mu through your body. And if you just keep going, it's going to happen. When it happens is really your karma, you know. That's your life patterns, your life history, you know, whatever. But just hang in there. And if you've finished the mu koan and you're working on some post mu koans, don't be surprised if they're difficult too. You know, people do the breath perception koan first in our tradition, and then they go ahead and do mu. And people work with the breath perception koan until they can enter deep samadhi on a fairly regular basis. And then you get the mu koan, and that sometimes takes people years to work through. At the last sesshin, there was a person who's been working, I think, on the mu koan for 5 years, who did a wonderful job. That person really had a breakthrough at the last sesshin. So I think it's been 4 or 5 years that person's been working on the mu koan. You work on it a long time, and you might think, and I often say, This is the foundation for practice. This is the most important koan. Master Umen says, you know, once you've answered the Mu Koan, your eyebrows will be interwoven with the eyebrows of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. So you're very close, see. Your eyebrows are interwoven. You can image that in your mind, you know, what that would be like, you know. So you pass the Mu Koan and you think, okay, you know, my eyebrows are intertwined with the eyebrows of the Buddhas and the patriarchs, you know. And then I give you another koan and it's like, well, what the hell, you know. I'm back in the same old place. I don't know what's going on. I don't have an answer, you know. It's day four of the session, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, once you can enter Mu Xin deeply, you have all the equipment you need to answer all the koans. You really do. But you have to figure out how to use your Mu power, right? And as I've said before, it's a little bit like those, you know, you have those cases where somebody's been blind from birth and then they do an operation and the person can see, but at first, having a functional eyes doesn't mean you can really see. You know, they've done experiments with people who have had this kind of surgery, and they have a hard time distinguishing, for example, between an apple and a picture of an apple. And it's because they don't have depth perception yet, which has to be learned, right? So you know, you can have the functioning eyes and not be able to see very well because you haven't yet learned how to use those functioning eyes. So once you have a Mu, you're able to enter deep Mu Xin, you may not yet be able fully to use those eyes, you know. So you might say, well, what's the problem, you know? I'm in blankness, I'm calling whatever my koan is, you know, one potato, two potato, whatever, you know. nothing's happening, right? You know? What's going wrong? No, but nothing's going wrong. You know, sometimes you just have to stay there long enough for something to happen. In many cases, the koan is asking you about the moment. A lot of koans are just asking you. In fact, you could almost say every koan is just asking you about some aspect of the present moment, right? So. The thing is, you know, it takes a while for us to recognize what it is about the moment that the koan wants us to encounter. And whatever you do, don't try to figure it out with your discriminating intellect. Just enter blank mind, keep saying the koan over and over again, and something will pop up, right? Something will arise. Don't try to reason it through, right? You know, that's always a mistake, always counterproductive, it never works, you know. So you just sit there and sometimes answers are coming up, but we don't notice that they're valuable, right? Sometimes people are actually encountering what the koan is trying to get them to notice, but they keep ignoring it. Like, oh yeah, that's not important, wait a minute. You know, I'm waiting for Kensho, right? I'm waiting for a Kensho experience, and I just keep noticing this annoying fact, you know. And sometimes people come in to talk to me and in Dokusan, and they'll say, I'm getting nowhere, you know, and they'll say something like, yeah, and the other day this happened, you know, and I go, oh, well, that's the answer, you know. they passed it by completely because they weren't used, it's new territory, and they just walked by it 20 times and didn't pay any attention to it because they were looking for something else. The conceptual mind was leading them in some other direction. You know, you've all seen those Where's Waldo drawings, you know, where there's a guy hidden in this complex picture, right? And koan training is a lot like that sometimes, right? You know, you're trying to find something, but you don't know where to look. And the pattern is just going to arise, sort of present itself all of a sudden, right? You just have to, stay in the blank mind and let your attention just travel freely, right? Just sort of unfocused, ambient attention, sort of unfocused, watching the moment, blank mind, watching the moment. See, that's how to do it. You know, if you begin to say, "Oh, I've got to answer this call, or I'm going to be a failure," right? That makes it an impossible situation, right? It'll just drive you crazy. So you have to just be in the blank mind, and then just let your attention direct your attention to the moment, and just keep calling the koan. So, you know, basically that's all it takes. You know, sometime at some point you're going to look down and go, "Oh, there's Waldo, right in the jungle. You know, I see his face now." It's just like that. Of course, you know, sometimes it takes a different form. It might, some koans want you to do something. Some koans are pointing to some aspect of the moment. Some koans are pointing to some aspect of the self, you know. But you don't have to figure anything out. Just stay in blank mind. So, you know, the goal of Zen practice is beautifully stated in this koan, you know. Somebody said, what is Joshu anyway? You're the great Joshu. What are you, you know? And Joshu says, North Gate, South Gate, East Gate, West Gate. So, yeah, everything can pass through these open gates, you know. No barriers. See? No barriers. This is what we have, all these blockages, all these obstacles that we've created in our lives. And we keep bumping up against them in koan training, and one by one we sort of take them away, right? And the big barriers, it takes a number of sessions. Little by little, become more open, you know, become less frightened, more in contact with life, less judgmental. The moment is inherently Buddha. It's inherently Buddha. But it's not the moment we wanted. See, that's the basic problem. This moment is Buddha. This moment is enlightenment, but it's not the moment we wanted. And that conflict is what makes us so unhappy, so tense and fearful. And little by little, if we take away all the barriers, this moment is Buddha. Yeah? So everybody's doing a wonderful job at encountering your blockages and working them through. And just have a blank mind, and say the koan, and everything's going to be wonderful. And when you see Waldo, is you know, just nobody can say for sure. Just keep looking, believe me, you know, if you're you know, just keep going. It will work out, you know. And in the meantime, you know, actually, there's something just wonderful about the practice itself. Something liberating, actually, just about struggling on the cushion. And that may not seem obvious right now if your legs are screaming in pain, but the minute you, well, it can, you know. Sometimes you can be in a lot of pain, and all of a sudden it's like a light switch is on, and you suddenly have like joy in your heart. You think, where is that coming from? Or, you know, after this period of sitting, you know, I'll ring the bell, everybody will get up and go to the bathroom, and you'll be sitting in the bathroom and thinking, you know, I really like to pee. I love peeing, you know. How many times did that happen during the day, right? You think, this is heaven, right? Going to the bathroom is heaven, right? So that's also thanks to your zazen, you know. And monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the East Gate, the West Gate, the North Gate, the South Gate.